but my husband and I are $2,000 richer, and all we had to do was spend an entire day in LAX. At the time,
the hourly rate on that is pretty good.
No, yeah? It's not. I was about to say it's not. Basically, like 5 hours into this, I realized that like when I work for a large brand, my minimum consulting fee is $500 an hour. So I did play myself, but I didn't have to do anything. So, you know, yeah, maybe it all does work out.
Yeah, you didn't have to do much consulting. So I feel like it's okay that the fee was a little lower.
I didn't do any consulting. I spent my entire meal voucher in small increments.
What did you get?
I did get some sushi. I know airport sushi is like rolling the dice, but
yeah, it's a little disgusting.
I think the death drive just took over.
Yeah. You were just kind of just like, either fly me out of here or like take me out in a casket.
Take me out in a body bag.
Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay, though. So the subject of your talk, it was kind of like a, you know, one woman episode of Tasteland, you could say.
Yeah, well, that's how I pitched it to them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The famous podcast, Tasteland. Yeah.
Yeah, before this was a glimmer in our eyes. I haven't seen the recording yet. In a sense, I'm also excited
there's a recording.
To see. There will be. Yeah. I'm also excited to see what I said.
Yeah.
Because I am one of those people where I go on stage and just
black out in the booth.
Yeah, exactly. Like, public speaking Daisy takes over. I know that I brought a water bottle on stage with me and began with a reference to that Kanye West water bottle tweet.
On the plane, yeah.
What also involves planes and airports. Maybe everything does.
This weekend it did.
And then I asked, you know, the audience to babysit it for me, but I did not sip from it at any point.
Speaking of the audience, what the crowd at this thing. So, okay. So my understanding of what FWB Fest is it's like not really a music festival. It's not really a conference. It seems like it's kind of like an occasion where, you know, very online culture worker people come to link and build. It's like a vibes fest.
Yeah. So they have the music track and they have the sort of ideas track. So it's a combination of speaking, you know, workshops, panels, and speaking, and then also the music at night, which I don't go to a lot of festivals.
Yeah.
Most festivals aren't like that. Decade. I think maybe it's close to how South by Southwest started before South by Southwest became like much too sprawling and corporate.
Before it became an opportunity for the U.S. military to sponsor indie bands.
Right, right. Boeing, X, whatever. The Dare, sorry. Yeah. We were just talking about him. Sorry, buddy.
I like the girls who enlist. Okay, anyways.
Yeah, no, like what rhymes with Palantir? Let's get into it. So the target audience, though, because FWB Club began as like this on-chain community, I would say if you took like the very small portion of people that are crypto literate that also are culturally literate and you sort of like skimmed them out of the top of the pool, that's who we're talking to.
Yeah. Like you.
Like me. But I saw W. David Marks there. I saw Toby Shorin. I did not catch our friend Ryan Broderick's speech, which I'm upset about.
Pity.
Nor did I run into him. So I'm very sorry, Ryan, if you're listening to this. But I started my talk with, my talk was a bit of a Franken presentation. I combined a couple of presentations I've done before, one for an audience of artists about how they might turn their studio practice or how they might take advantage of the taste economy,
to make what they do a business, which I feel like is like the struggle. Like, I feel like that's so many people I talk to for Creator Spotlight. It's like, they either are like a great writer or they're a great business person. And there's vanishingly few people who are both. Like, that's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, I have like a list of people in my head who are sort of at the intersection of both. And I find myself reaching out to them often for solidarity.
Give me like one name drop. Who do you think does that well?
Emily Sundberg is totally fantastic. Maya Kosoff, fantastic. More people that I'm not thinking of, but those two definitely. And I don't think it's surprising that they have their own business now and newsletters.
Yeah.
So, and then the other presentation that sort of went into, fed into this presentation, was a presentation I had done at MetaLabel for an audience of people that are interested in indie publishing. But the piece that was new was I needed something to bookend it. Mm-hmm. So I pulled in the cover of this book that I read when I was younger called The Search for Delicious by Natalie Babbitt. And she's more famous for writing Tuck Everlasting. Okay. So I actually was like, raise your hand if you read this book. And nobody raised their hand. And I was like, sweet, I'm bringing you a rare.
You're making the taste.
Grail.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the premise of that book is basically the king of the kingdom wants to write a dictionary. He needs a definition for every word. He cannot come up with a definition for delicious. So he sends out like this young squire to survey everyone. And everyone is so, you know, in their feelings about feeling strongly about what the definition of delicious should be that it almost leads to a civil war. And so I was trying to use that as a way to say, like, taste is entirely subjective. We don't mm-hmm. even necessarily have a definition. And we're not going to come to a definition through this presentation. But then I ended with the book again and said, but now you potentially have a framework to come up with your own definition. So that was fun and made me want to reread that book.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. Sounds like a good book.
Yeah, it is a good book. You know, I got a little bit into the history of taste and I was pulling on some writing that my friend Ruby Thello has mm-hmm. done. Ruby was also there, ran into them. But basically, like, Ruby traces that moment of like industrialization in Britain and in Europe when consumers went from being like default rich people to this new class of consumers that was basically like the bourgeoisie. So all of a sudden, like within this new class of consumers, there began to be like these lines drawn between who has taste and who doesn't. And it was because it was still like the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s. Obviously, we had to attach some morality play to this. Mm-hmm. So I put like up a Virgin Chad meme, and the Virgin was like wretched commercial spending, and the uh-huh. Chad was virtuous consumption. And then I talked about how that sort of like carried over into the American colonies at the time, that like a lot of these early, you know, we had the Federalist Papers as a precursor mm-hmm. to like writing the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. The conversation about taste was not separate from the conversation about like what makes a good citizen in a democracy. They were like yeah. completely parallel, because the biggest question around taste at the time, which again has these like moral and religious overtones, is like, is it innate? And mm-hmm. they were asking, like, at the same time, is democracy innate? Is being a good citizen innate? Are human rights innate? And then at the same mm-hmm. time, they're asking, like, is taste innate? So I think that that's a really interesting thing to highlight, because taste has always had these socio-political ramifications and been part of yeah. the same debate about what does it mean to be, like, not just a consumer, but a citizen. And I didn't stay on that too long, but that was, like, kind of the brief history thing yeah. that I gave.
I think, well, that's really interesting, because as I was like thinking about what I was going to talk about today on this episode, I was thinking about how taste like is a civic duty, because you have a responsibility. I'm thinking now of like when the people I interview for Career Spotlight, where they're like, I often ask people, like, what do you think your responsibility is to your audience? And I think, I don't know, maybe most people don't really have an answer. Like, they've never thought about that. But I think when you have an audience, you know, you do have a responsibility, because like, if people are listening to you, if your opinions, like, you know, whatever media you consume ultimately shapes you in some way, even if it's in like opposition. Right. So I think it is a civic duty to like be conscious about your taste. I don't know, but you said you didn't linger on that too long. Do you think a civic duty?
Should I read the Gay Chingy tweet?
Please do.
Yeah. I don't think I can say it as well as
it was so well articulated by Twitter user Gay Chingy.
The Gay Chingy, actually.
Excuse me.
So, okay. Let people have fun is almost always used to the effect of let tasteless morons go out without having to know they are tasteless morons, which is so odd. Should be used more to the effect of bring Quaaludes back into worldwide production with ready access to me and the homies.
Yeah.
So I think that that's definitely a comment on the state of our civic life.
Mm-hmm. Let people have fun too. I feel like when I can't help but think of Let People Have Fun as being like about like Marvel movies and like young adult books.
I mean, I think they would be having more fun if they were on Quaaludes, but this actually really well dovetail with W. David Marks's presentation, which drew heavily on his book, Status and Culture. And I've interviewed him about that book in the past. But the thing that really stuck out to me, and I think a lot of other people in the audience, well, my husband primarily, because that's who I talked about it after, is like...
Your most vocal critic and fan.
Yeah, well, they were sitting next to each other during the presentation. I was like, well, two people that I most want to impress in this audience. But this idea of kitsch, where like David explains how kitsch isn't necessarily like bad art. It's art that doesn't offer anything new. It's derivative. And his presentation, I would say, was primarily about cultural stagnation. I actually emailed him ahead of time and I was like, I'm going to talk about taste. Are you going to talk about taste? And he was like, no, I'm talking about cultural stagnation. I was like, great. They complemented each other, but we weren't on the same beat. But when you create the conditions, like which we sort of arguably have now, like thinking of Marvel, where everything is a franchise and you're creating more kitsch than you're creating new stuff.
IP is kitsch.
Yeah, really. I mean, the first time it's created, no, but I think when it takes on the aura of IP, it's already sort of post-kitsch. That it's kitsch isn't like you've created something terrible. Kitsch isn't necessarily like, you know, that movie The Room, which is, I would say, more like camp. But he still came down pretty hard and said, like, we should punish kitsch, or by which I don't want to put words in his mouth. I think he was saying, like, really strongly disincentivize it, because if it becomes the predominant format, like,
it's a death spiral for
culture. It's a death spiral for culture, and it's a death spiral for the people who make their living off of culture. So all of those ideas, I think I had heard him express before in various places, but he did a fantastic job pulling it together for this audience and pulling in more recent examples, including the Hawk Tua girl and her new line of sauces. So congrats, girl.
Who's the team behind that? Like doing that? Like it's been, it was
Satan? I feel like,
Satan's helpers.
Not Jin Lane.
Out of LA. Not Jin Lane. I feel like, how long ago? It was Hawk Tua, like, 2 weeks ago now?
I can't remember, it feels like it was three months ago. I think Joe Biden was still the candidate when that happened.
Yeah,
so
he probably was.
I'm surprised Hawk Tua made it through the vibe shift.
Yeah. I'm sure she'll be stumping for somebody. She was, I mean, that was the weirdest thing so far about that. It's probably been like her and RFK at the Nashville crypto convention.
Oh, I don't even know that we can get into RFK. We should not.
Should not. Okay, kitsch though. I think I don't know. When I think of kitsch, then there too, it's like I think the ultimate kitsch. I've seen many of the Marvel movies. Sure, I've not seen any of the Deadpool ones. But to me, Ryan Reynolds rubs me the wrong way. I feel like he's the definition of kitsch. It's like too self-aware. Like whenever I've seen like a preview of the Deadpool movies, it's like every line is like a reference to itself. I don't know. Have you encountered this?
Yeah, I think I've definitely encountered it, and I don't want to force transition you into our next topic, but like, I think one of the reasons why local media and publications like The Village Voice were so powerful is because they employed people who did not create kitsch, who were
too within the thing. They weren't commentating on it. Yeah.
They were coming directly out of scenes that were meant to create art that challenged people, and the critics of that art were also fluent in that language and were able to bring the reader along with them. And we've definitely like lost some of that. I don't know if you want to go into that now or later in the segment. I can talk to you a little bit more about Fest first, but I definitely wanted to talk about that parallel. You want to go into the Village Voice?
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. The thing that I sent you was a review of The Freaks Came Out to Write, which is an amazing new definitive history of The Village Voice by Tricia Romano. Neither of us have read the book, but we both read Alex Press's review and Jacobin. However you pronounce that.
Far be it from me.
Yeah, far be it from you. Yeah. All right. Well, leftist credentials revoked. But there was a line that really stood out to me. I think it's a quote from somebody in the book, and I'm just going to read it out if that's okay.
Please do.
It was as if the ragtag group of writers and editors knew everything and everyone. That's because they did. It's why they were hired. The paper prioritized experience, though not in the sense publishers usually mean. So they prioritized experience in the subject that these people would be writing about, whether it's restaurants or, you know, performance art, music. And then later in the review, though, it talks about people from the Village Voice who went on to write for other publications. And I felt like the implication of that was that a certain percentage of what was written in the Village Voice and the talent that was cultivated was absorbed into the mainstream, which is not necessarily a bad thing if being absorbed into the mainstream is part of that cycle of challenging artwork that David talked about, which is the challenging artwork is created. The critic brings it, the smart critic, the good critic brings it to the audience who maybe is initially repelled by it before it becomes absorbed into, you know, people's understanding of art or the world. And, you know, you could use the example of like abstract expressionism, which of course the CIA was also pushing. But, you know, think about the first people that saw Rothko versus how we talk about Rothko today, which I feel like there was maybe a few months back a tweet trying to dunk on Rothko and like, it was like the Avengers of normies assembling to defend Rothko, which
you could say this at any point in time. I feel like over the next last 5 years, I feel like every few months there's one of these like Rothko tweets. And then, I mean, we were talking about this, I think maybe last time or recently, where it's like the, my kid could do that conversation, but it's like, but they didn't because it's about doing it first and not doing the derivative and not like following the instructions of the thing itself. Right.
Absolutely. And you have like writers like Vivian Gornick, who got her start in The Village Voice. One of my mentors, Laurie Stone, was a theater critic for The Voice for a long time. And I wanted to read out something that she says in her book, Everything is Personal, about The Village Voice, because I think it's a really good encapsulation of The Village Voice as a scene, but also like what it felt like to be inside that scene. And I know that she was interviewed by Trisha Romano. So this is, I'm just going to read out a paragraph from a review that I wrote of Everything is Personal for the LA Review of Books. The Village Voice, where Stone built her reputation as a critic, poses as another unattainable character in Everything is Personal. In Grieving the Voice, which shut down in September 2017, Stone again reveals her tenderness for the unreachable, past, present, and future. She writes of her days on staff, "I feel part of something I have never felt part of before, not even in the women's movement. Everyone has more cool and swagger than me. No one wants to be in love with a sure thing." And then I ended up tying that to this quote from a book I absolutely love by Chelsea Hodson called Tonight I'm Someone Else, where she writes, "My love feels so good when I aim at an untouchable person, but then I always touch them." So what I like about this was even inside the scene, the people who were involved, and I have complicated feelings about scenes for this reason, because I think everyone's always trying to get to the center, but there is no center. It always moves the closer you feel to it. So the closer you feel to being cool, the goalposts move again. And I think chasing after that can create a lot of weird behaviors, cough, dime square. But I also think that tension produces really good art, right? Like if you feel like it's your duty to earn your place, to impress, that
this is this desperation that drives you.
Yeah, like nothing is a sure thing. Nothing is a given. She's really talking about like being in love with her job and being in love with The Village Voice as like this. Yeah, it was like almost like a lover in her life. And I think it's rare now for media to produce that. Like, I would love the people who are involved with dirt to feel not a sense of insecurity, because I really want everyone involved around dirt to feel totally secure, but like a drive to have a stake in this thing. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that passion goes away when you enter, well, the kitsch cycle, right?
Yeah.
Like, who's going to feel like, nobody feels like kitsch is like a lover they're trying to impress. But like, also when you're just trying to keep your job, it's really hard to be in love with your job.
Well, so, I mean, that's kind of what makes it hard, right? Is it's like when the Village Voice was at its peak, like when at the time, you know, The Freaks Come Out to Write, when that book was written about, it's like, there's like the, you know, the capital implications of that, where rent was still like a few hundred dollars or whatever. It was possible to like put your all into this. Whereas now, like, I think maybe like not even about New York. I feel like for me, whenever I think about media generally, it's just like a spiral, a drain down to New York, which I think is because I live in New York. And for like, you know, since I was a teenager, I was like consuming media about New York.
From the farm.
What? From the farm.
No, Francis is on the farm right now.
I am on the farm right now. It's which, you know, far from the towering skyscrapers of Ridgewood, Queens.
All right.
But I guess what I'm thinking of is like, I want to think about like other media outside of New York, like other local media. The person I'm writing about for this week's Creator Spotlight, this is not that far from New York, admittedly, but I'm writing about this woman, Umbrina Lee, and her newsletter, Central Daisy, which is like, I think it's a little under 3,000 subscribers, somewhere around there. She started it 2 years ago. And I think a lot of the people I talk to for Creator Spotlight are like these, like, you know, creators who are making stuff about themselves, for themselves. Like, it's, you know, even like Ryan Broderick, you know, like, I love his newsletter, but it's from his voice and it's like his point of view on internet culture. Whereas this one, it's like, it's less her writing about it. She's like very much a serious journalist, taking like the main thing she's done for the last year or so. About a year ago, she got an $80,000 grant from the state of New Jersey to fund a fellowship. So I think it was 5 young journalism fellows, and she edited them, and they wrote stories that were like about and or relevant to the Desi, the South Asian diaspora in New Jersey. So that's like where it's local too. And I think she has visions of it being like more about, like, more for and about the diaspora, like across the United States, etc. But where I'm going with this, like, connection to like talking about the Village Voice and how people are so passionate about that, like, people, I think she and the fellows she works with are so passionate about this project because it is like an underserved media niche. Like, she, part of why she wanted to do it was because the local news in New Jersey like wasn't covering these stories. There just was like, it's like somewhere between 5 to 10% of the population of New Jersey is South Asian, but it's like far less than that where the story is being covered. But going back to the funding idea, it's like, the only way she could make this work was with grant funding. And she just got renewed for a $100,000 grant. So she's doing it again and it's working. But like, she was about to quit and pack it up a year ago because she'd been trying to do it by herself for a year. And like, she's also employed full time and like is a parent and like does, you know, some freelance journalism. And it was just like, it was too much. But then she got this grant and she started working with this other guy as a project manager. So that to me is like really cool as this like serious journalism by a community, about the community, like recreating and reinforcing the culture of this community and like, you know, making a canon of it. But they're only able to do it because they got $80,000 in grant funding and then again $100,000.
Well, so, I think local journalism is an excellent argument for journalism as a public good, that it should mm-hmm. be funded alongside other public goods. I'm obviously not the only one to make that argument. And how it has been funded, though, is Village Voice was kept afloat by like the back pages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we might get into this later, but now we see like there's an article in Wired about you know, the sort of like dark web of like AI slop and OnlyFans listings
mm-hmm.
propping up SEO traffic and then, you know, by extension, third-party advertising revenue on previously reputable websites. But I think it's important to acknowledge that, like, the Village Voice was reputable, and there's no really debate that, like, just, like, advertisements for sex work were always part of the local news and newspaper yeah. model. I think the way that that's been transitioned to the web is a lot more controversial. But I also think like what made it controversial was a lot of like, you know, vice laws, mm-hmm. some of which were supposedly to protect the workers, well, but not really.
It's also like the visibility though, right? Like the separation, the visibility, like before it was like the Village Voice was a, you know, alt weekly in New York that you could only buy in New York. Whereas now, like I just went to the Village Voice.
Yeah, and like don't flip to the back if you don't want to see some titties. Yeah.
But like now I just, you know, typed in villagevoice.com and there's oh my God, it's gone now. A week ago, so I typed, you know, the hamburger menu or whatever to see the different sections. There's the front, the city, the culture. Mm. A week ago, or however, like a few days ago, there was also OnlyFans was the fourth thing there. And then there was like the alphabetical list of like 100 different types of OnlyFans. It's not there anymore.
I believe you.
Yeah. I sent you a screenshot of it. So wait, that's actually really interesting. Why is it gone? Like, did they read the article?
Turned on the light and the bugs scattered.
Yeah. That's crazy.
I'm sure there was some blowback around that.
But
like this comes up when people are like, the internet solved for distribution of media. It did not solve for monetization. And I was at like a roundtable discussion at Union Square Ventures a few months ago, and like Peter Kafka was there and he was like, the news business was never making money. Or if it was making money, it was around this type of stuff of, you know, having a back pages or having a sort of tabloid business to subsidize the more serious journalism. The internet did not solve that.
Yeah.
It got journalism out to a bigger audience. It made it more accessible.
But it also made the expectation that, you know, information is free.
Oh, it also replaced print advertising, which was lucrative, with digital advertising, which, you know, at least to the extent that it relies on traffic. And, you know, we could dig more into really specific digital advertising for places like Airmail or Axios. But we don't know how Axios is doing. They laid off 50 people this morning. But, you know, like there is digital advertising that's very targeted where you can be charging a lot, you know, enough to be a profitable business. But the sort of like baseline third party ad that you're going to be delivered through like a widget, you know, is not competition for what Condé Nast was bringing in on those magazine ads in the September issue. So the internet, you know, it solved some problems, but it created new ones, and it never really solved the problem of monetization, which I think Peter is really right to underscore, because I think there were periods in which it gave the illusion that it had, but what we were really seeing was venture dollars pouring into BuzzFeed and Vice, who have now ruined it for everyone. So thank you so much for your $1 billion valuation.
Contribution to the culture.
You know, it makes it a lot harder for me to make an argument for my very modest valuation. But yeah, I think there was the illusion that monetization had been solved, but all that we were seeing was aspiration, distribution,
and bets by venture
capitalists. Kombucha on tap, falsely subsidized by the same people that brought you Palantir. Thank you.
I have supped it. I have supped, you know, let you has not sipped the free kombucha.
Yeah,
the Gorgon space cast the first stone. Yeah.
Well, we all did.
Okay, wait. So a funding model, like another local media, like I was just talking about this one where it only works because it's grant funded and it's serious journalism. One that's like very different, but just another person I've interviewed is this guy, Ryan Sneddon, who he is in Annapolis, Maryland. He has this newsletter called the Naptown Scoop. It's every weekday.
Great name.
It's, I guess that's the local, you know, the Naptown Scoop. It's like a daily thing. I think each one is about 800 words. And about half of the word count is events. It's like music listings, sports listings. I don't believe there was any original reporting. Like maybe it like highlights a few important stories in other outlets nearby. But when I talked to him like 6 months ago, he had 18,000 subscribers to that, and he was making $200,000 revenue a year, because it was all local ads, and there was like three or four, it depended per issue, but there was like three or four ads per. And it was all local businesses. And he kind of was operating it all He had, I think, one or two dedicated ad buyers, maybe one or two dedicated writers, but everything was like part time. You know, it's only $200,000 yearly revenue. But that to me is like so different from the Central Daisy one, where it's like that's very serious journalism, like one story a week, multiple writers. And then this is like a, you know, he's just like calling up all the different bars. That's how he started, calling up all the different bars and venues and be like, hey, like, what are the, you know, what music is happening there for the next month, and then putting it together, and then getting a guy who sells like multi-million dollar waterfront real estate listings to, you know, have like the marquee advertisement all year, where that guy can spend like, I don't know how much he's actually spending, but let's say he's spending like $50,000 a year to advertise in here, and like he makes that back in one sale, right? So like he only needs one sale. So that was like, and this guy too, no journalism background. He was an engineer in college, and then he, after college, he found the 6 a.m. City newsletters, which is like a big network of local newsletters now, and he started doing it. So that is like, that's a funding model that works, but it works because it's like every single day, except for weekends, and it's in a wealthy area, and he's catering. His market is like 60% women, mostly like older than 40, I think it was. So he's catering to these wealthy middle-aged women who, you know, are going to maybe buy a house. So that's, it's, you know, it's a matter of like audience volume and like local advertisers he can work with.
That's how you do it. You have to know your audience. And
yeah,
I mean, Dirt's been called, somebody called it the village voice of the internet, which made me so happy, because in a sense that doesn't really make sense, because the internet is a collection of scenes. But mm-hmm. You know, I like the idea in theory of the internet being its own culture that could theoretically have a village voice to delve into also those cultural pockets. But, you know, the one thing that I did, if somebody wants to copy me, free idea, but I already did it. You know, like obviously
to do it now.
It's not available for me to like call up a bar and be like, do you want to advertise in Dirt? Because my audience is global.
Yeah.
But, you know, one thing that I have done is Esquire published an article by my friend Kate Dwyer about how hard it is for debut authors to market their books. So I went through our entire email list. I emailed everyone that works in publishing. I said, we saw the Esquire article. We want to let you know that you can market your debut authors in Dirt. And not only can you market in Dirt, but if it's a debut author, if it's their first book, I'll cut you a deal.
Nice.
And we're going to run this, you know, this deal, you know, whatever. So, and that works. So people bought ads for debut author books. And I think that's like an example of knowing your audience. If you don't have the sort of like main street, small business, mm-hmm. local opportunity available to you. And also like, I hate to say it, don't know how many of our readers are buying houses right now. Yeah. Like you have to meet.
Look, I'm a reader. I'm nowhere near buying a house.
Right. Well, I you have a farm. So
yeah. Well, it's not my farm,
but it could be someday.
I don't want it. I'll be honest with you.
I want it.
You want it?
Francis, well, so when I was in the airport, look, when you were in the airport, I wasn't taunting you. When I was in the airport, you were sending me photos of like pancakes with fresh peaches and blueberries.
Actually, it was crepes. It was crepes.
Oh, God. Just twisting the knife.
See, that is the thing. That's the nice thing about being out here is I'm eating very, you know, sun gold tomatoes off the vine.
Yeah.
Blueberry, you know, blueberries by the handful. You know, they're spilling.
You do look a little blue. I'm not gonna lie. Hey Tom, can we do some color correct? So Tom is our producer, right? His name's Tom.
Yes, his name's Tom.
Yeah, Tom's our producer, and now he's gonna become a character. So if you guys are wondering why I'm not moving around so much this week.
You could move your hands. You know, it's anti-Italian discrimination, like you said.
Yeah. Well, I was told I need to stay a foot from my mic, and I'm trying to behave. But if I look like I'm not having a good time this week, that's why. And it made me think of when we were younger, my mom's trick to keep us in our high chair. She would put us in overalls, and then she would take the straps of the overalls, and she would like run them through the back of the high chair.
So that's
we were
so smart.
Strapped and so smart. And that's, I feel like I've mentally like strapped myself to my husband's gaming chair. So not moving around as much this week, but it is very difficult for me to express myself without my hands.
Is he a gamer? Does he just have the gaming chair?
Oh yeah, he is. Why would he have this? I mean, for ergonomics.
That's like a thing. Yeah. I feel like that's a thing. Like, you know, people work from home. People will have like a gaming chair because they're built for sitting in for 15 hours on end.
I mean, all of the above. So, you know, I'm struggling right now, but seeing everyone shower Nancy Pelosi with praise for being a strong Italian woman is giving me the strength to, to get through today's ordeal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, speaking about being on the farm, now I'm thinking about, like, the local media here, right? Mm. And, like, when I was growing up, there was two things. There was the, like, I think it was, like, a monthly thing that was, like, you know, what was it called when it's, it was called the Journal. And then there was another weekly one that was, like, the I, that was even more alternative. But, like, as a kid, I would love to read the Journal. And usually I'd, you know, go to, like, the movie listings and, like, restaurant reviews, the typical, like, the culture stuff. And then sometimes I'd read one of the front page things, but now, like, at some point, I don't know how long ago it was now, like 7 or 10 years ago, it became like there's this online thing, the Lost Coast Outpost, that became like the main source. And that is, like, you know, I don't know. I'm actually really curious how big of an operation they have, but now that's, like, all, like, the live, like, bookings and stuff, and, like, you know, original journalism too. But I remember feeling that it was so odd to me. It must have been, like, sometime when I was in college, it's like a decade ago, that, like, this became the local media. And it felt so strange to me that, like, my, like, small town, you know, hometown, like, middle of nowhere, Northern California coast, now had, like, an online media portal, or portal's not the right word, but you know what I mean? Like, it was like, I always thought of this place as somewhere that was so, like, isolated from the world and from the internet. And that's partially why I wanted to leave. But then it, you know, that became, like, the sustainable model for local journalism here. I don't know if it's sustainable, but it's been going for 10 years. So.
So you want to hear a farm story that relates to the voice? So I saved this for you if we had time. So, when I read Alex Press's, review, I remember that Norman Mailer was actually one of the founders of the Village Voice.
Oh, and I had no idea.
A few years ago, I was supposed to write this story, which I never ended up writing, about Norman Mailer. And he was involved in, like, a hashish smuggling operation that involved running drugs through a farm in Maine.
Oh. Wow, this is such a you story.
Excuse me.
It's just the main. I'm pigeonholing you.
No, it's fine. I just, you know, sorry. I can't be contained. See, look, I'm already starting to move. I moved closer to the mic. You almost got me there.
No. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, so he had two friends, Buzz Farber and Richard Stratton, who were also involved in this. They went to prison. He did not. And basically, the feds, whatever, desperately wanted to link Norman Mailer to this, but they weren't able to. But like, the theory is that, like, Farber and Stratton got worse sentences kind of out of retaliation for not being able to link Mailer. So I'm going to take you through some of this story. And this comes from the pitch that I wrote about this. So I researched it a lot ahead of time. But basically, Buzz Farber went to prison for 6 years for conspiracy to import, actual importation, and conspiracy to distribute hashish, which originally came from Lebanon. And Farber was working for this guy, Richard Stratton, who later wrote an autobiography called Smuggler's Blues, a true story of the hippie mafia.
It's such a good name.
And both men basically got harsher sentences for their refusal to implicate Mailer. But in Farber's case, he actually did try to get Mailer. He wore a wire when he ate dinner with Mailer at Armando's in Brooklyn Heights. And they even know what they were eating. They said veal parmesan and spaghetti al burro. And Stratton straight up refused to cooperate with the government. So he was arrested in Maine after buying out a farm that he co-owned with Mailer. And he basically ran his smuggling business close to the Canadian border. They were, like, 60 miles from the border. But there was, like, a lot of concern for Farber, particularly because I guess he had a few, like, nervous breakdowns. Like, his mental health was a little bit more delicate. They were concerned that he, like, would not do well in prison. So the reason I found out about this story is when I was working at the New York Review of Books, I found this letter from a bunch of famous people that was published in the New York Review of Books, basically asking for Farber's sentence to be commuted. Hmm. So they wrote a letter to New York Review of Books in 1987. Decrying the injustice of his sentence. And basically, this is a quote from the letter. It says, Buzz Farber has suffered and will continue to suffer, not only with remorse about his crime, but because of the government's continued hope that somehow, through the enormous pressure being brought to bear on him, they will be able to get Mailer and make much capital out of indicting and attempting to convict this innocent, at least to this matter. Mailer was not, he's not a not good a, guy.
Not a goody two-shoes.
Internationally known literary figure. And the signatories include Nora Ephron, George Plimpton, and Gay Tillies. And basically, they think the government was targeting Mailer because of his stance against the Vietnam War and because he liked to attack Nixon. So there's some more stuff. I mean, ultimately, it's a really sad story because Buzz Farber committed suicide after he was released from prison.
Oh, shit.
And Mailer was really shocked by this. But Farber's daughter, Jennifer, who worked for Esquire, has written about this whole situation as well. And basically said that like Mailer was like totally in denial about how much of this and the ultimate outcome had to do with him, basically. Yeah. I think he was kind of just like, well, my friends are in prison. This is like kind of badass. They'll come out, they'll write about it. And like, this is going to kind of up their street cred almost and not like, these people are kind of taking the fall for me and, you know, could lead to a lot of trauma.
He was like looking at it more as like an opportunity for like raw material for writing rather than a real life being.
Well, yeah, to quote Nora Ephron, who some is kind of in this story a little bit in an adjacent way. I think he had an everything is copy mentality about it. So, which I'm sure is how he got into smuggling drugs in the first place.
Yeah.
Part of it. So yeah, that's my tie-in between Farms and the Village Voice.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good, I think that everything is copy. That's the way I take that sometimes is like doing it for the anthropology of it which is like whenever I'm at like a diner in a weird place, as I was once a year or two ago in a small town in Pennsylvania, and they have like some weird thing on the menu, I like have to order it where I'm like, this is, you know, I got to do it for journalism's sake.
When that's how I feel about minting NFTs.
You know, I have two. That's all I have. I unfortunately did not mint a dirt NFT, but yeah, when I said doing it for the journalism, it usually means like then telling it to you in a situation like this, or, you know, just in other storytelling situations. But I did have a blue cheese hot wing omelet in a small town in Pennsylvania. It was, I would not get it again, but it was not as bad as you think.
I didn't think it. I actually thought it sounded pretty good. Sounds to pretty be honest.
Good. Well, it was pretty
so
good.
So was it buffalo chicken, pieces of buffalo chicken, but also blue cheese as the sort of like cheese element of this
it
omelet?
It was not. No. It was like blue cheese. It was like blue cheese wing sauce poured on top of the omelet.
What was it in wasn't the like omelet? Good blue cheese.
What was in the omelet was buffalo chicken. That was it. Shredded buffalo chicken in a buffalo sauce with the blue cheese. with the blue cheese on top.
No, that sounds great. I love all of those things. I would eat that.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think they go together.
Okay. Before we wrap up, I want to bring it back to FWB Fest one more time. Give me what was like the musical highlight? We didn't talk about the music at all.
Yeah, I realized that after we moved on from that, maybe prematurely. The music was unbelievable. It was so well put together. Like, kudos. You know, amazing balance between big acts and small acts. And I've heard like booking. So I might be wrong. This is what I heard. You know, somebody can write in and yell at me if this is wrong. Coachella doesn't just have like a exclusivity clause for that festival. They actually have a geographical,
it's like hundreds miles, right?
Which includes Idlewild.
Yeah.
So if you're running a festival in Idlewild, you cannot book. They could not book anyone that was at Coachella. So, you know, that's could be limiting, but I actually think is an opportunity to curate a better like list. And, you know, they had a headliner each night. So the first night it was Perfume Genius. Amazing. My favorite act.
Iconic.
Second night it was A.G. Cook. I knew Soulbreaker as Cook's like best track. Mm-hmm. And Soulbreaker has this amazing like animated music video. And I was shocked when I went to YouTube and it had sub like 200K. views, because it was incredible, and the graphics, it's almost like Studio Ghibli meets like cyberpunk. I sent it to you from the airport. So they had that going behind AG like while they were performing, and then I was able to watch it again on YouTube. Perfume Genius, I knew a lot of the songs, but like also smaller acts. Verite, unbelievable performer.
I'm not familiar.
OK Kaya, who I realized after, like, I have a bunch of OK Kaya stuff like liked on my Spotify, but just didn't even make the connection. Terza was there. Terza like performed in the dark, which was like an interesting decision, but I was
just on the stage. It's like the amphitheater too. It's not like, my understanding is it's like a very like, you know, layabout amphitheater, like a gentle grassy slope. And there's like not very many people there. So it's like everybody's kind of just sprawled out, has their own space. You're kind of just chilling.
Right? They had these like the bean bags that are almost like wind socks. So you like run and fill it with air and then twist it and you can lie on it. Yeah. I think that there's a canopy over the amphitheater that's like a permanent fixture of this arts academy, which I like, deeply regret not going to now. So yeah, it was very bucolic and not a ton of people there, not crowded, no line for the bathroom, which is like, I mean, I think I would go to more festivals if they were like this. And also like a lot of people that like, not gonna lie, I think they were on mushrooms and you know, maybe, well, we'll leave that open-ended, but you know, if you were theoretically on mushrooms, I think that that would be a very nice setting to experience music in.
I imagine.
And if somebody came up to you, you know, theoretically, if somebody came up to you on mushrooms and introduced themselves from your company Discord, you would still be able to maintain an entire conversation with them because you will have done your dose correctly.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it does. I have some things I want to say about music festivals too, but I think we should save that.
Oh, darn. We're out of time.
For next week.
I guess
we're out of time.
Cares.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week.